It's all about food. And I am actually in Florida and ready to do the show from here. It's been really a great tour. I premiered the Swinging Gourmets last week, which was really fun. And now I'm in Florida doing a number of talks at a variety of places. And it's always fun to meet the community and the people that are interested in food the way I am. Okay, so interesting show today. I'm looking forward to getting started. So let's do that. Why don't we? My first guest is Dr. Ismael Nuño, and he's the author of a book, The Spirit of the Heart. He has had a 35-year career as one of America's leading heart surgeons, and throughout his career, he has experienced his fair share of loss and triumph. He details his incredible journey as a heart surgeon in his new book, The Spirit of the Heart, Stories of Family, Hope, Loss, and Healing. Dr. Nuño, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am. I am in Los Angeles, and I'm hearing you from Florida.
You know, it's crazy. I love technology. It brings us all together. It's a good thing and a bad thing. You know, I talk about this all the time, and what we really need is balance. But I love the way I can speak to people all over the world.
Absolutely.
Okay, I read your book, and I really was touched by all your intimate thoughts about your career and the people that you connected with. And it's really a fascinating thing doing heart surgery.
Yes, it is. I wanted to do heart surgery ever since I was a kid. My entire life was oriented towards one day becoming a heart surgeon. My high school projects, science projects were on the heart. My papers in college were in the heart. Mm-hmm. And my training in surgery was in the heart. And it was a very fulfilling career. We operated in a lot of patients, saved a lot of lives. We lost some,
sure,
but there was learning in that. So that's why I wanted to produce a book, and the most important part of it was losing an 18-year-old daughter.
Yeah, I cannot imagine what that feels like. And I imagine just writing about it and sharing your thoughts and keeping her spirit alive is somewhat helpful.
Yes, it is. It was very I brought back a lot of memories. I keep on thinking about it. I can now speak with other parents who are having the same problems with their children. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very, very, very beneficial. So even though she's not with me physically, I keep her in my heart, and I talk to her and deal with her and, you know, get angry at her still. So,
well, one of the things that I enjoy about your book, there were a number of things, but one was the fact that you were open to some metaphysical thoughts about spirits leaving and connecting, which I think is so important, especially in the medical profession, because so many doctors turn off to that possibility because there's no scientific evidence for it.
Right. It's difficult to talk even amongst colleagues when you sit there having a cup of coffee and you're discussing certain events. They look at you like, yeah, you're nuts. And you're absolutely correct. You know, they do turn it off, but I think that those of us who are in the business, we really learn the respect, the sensitivity of not only a life, but a death, you know, just in a mm-hmm. blink of an eye. I opened up the book with my sister. We were flying to Paris, and her heart stopped, and I had to resuscitate her 35,000 feet. Luckily, things turned out well for her. but it's a blink of an eye. And that's exactly what happens when a family takes a loved one for heart surgery and everything is going well and you're patting yourself on the back and everything turned out fine. And then all of a sudden their heart stops, and it promotes an entire philosophy, not only existential but spiritually. What happens, I'm not talking about really what happens after death. I know nothing about it. And like you said, it's not scientifically proven, but there is a transition as you go from life to death that I think can be a very, in a way, beautiful aspect of it. When a patient I know is going to die and they're dying, and bring the family in, they can touch them, they can tell them how much they love them, and there is a lot to that that we ordinarily miss. When you have the loss, which is sudden, that's horrible. And everybody understands that, but if you know that it's coming, then I think that you can make appropriate changes in that moment so that you can help that person, put them at ease, tell them that you love them. And what's a better way of leaving this life than knowing that you have loved ones around you? I asked my wife, I said, when your time comes, if you had a choice of time and place, how would you do it? And she said, I would love to have my grandchildren around my bed.
And you had mentioned how many hospitals don't want young children in the presence of people who are sick.
Right. For a couple of things, a couple of reasons. One of them is the fact that we used to have the epidemiologic thought that a child was a harbinger of a lot of viruses, and if you brought them in, they could create an epidemic and that sort of thing. And so there were hospital policies against the child coming in. I really believe that a child can bring a lot of happiness to a person that is gravely ill, especially if they can make the contact and they're not in a coma. But even in a coma, you never really know how much people are taking it in, the patient is going to take in the love that comes from the family.
That's right. Well, I know that when I'm around small children, even if I'm in a bad mood, all of a sudden my mood changes. Young children, sure. We can learn so much from them, and we forget how to be like children, and we really should pay more attention to their childlike manner where everything is new and fresh and joyful.
I agree entirely.
Yeah. Now, another thing that I liked is when you talked about seeing the other side as a patient. A friend of mine, Dr. Robert Klitzman, wrote a book, When Doctors Become Patients, and I think it's something that doctors need to learn in their education, becoming a doctor, what it's like to be a patient, because there's so much arrogance, and the patients do not benefit from it.
Yes, I agree with you entirely. I learned a lot being in the hospital and just observing the way I was treated, and the poking of the needles and the attitude that some of them had. It was truly a learning experience. And when I was told that I was going into liver failure and that I was up for a liver transplant, it was so bizarre, Karen. Sitting there all night waiting for somebody to die so that I could have their liver.
Yes.
It was an incredible experience. And when morning came, I realized, I didn't die, number one. Number two, nobody gave me their liver, which was a good sign. And I learned a lot, and some of these moments when the sun comes up and you're thinking about your own life and your own mortality. They're beautiful moments, and moments that you just never forget.
I've done a bit of reading about transplants, and maybe you're familiar with this, but I've heard incredible stories about how there is memory not just in the brain, but in all parts of our body. And people who have transplants sometimes experience the memory of the person that they got their organ from.
You know, when you take a look at couples, all of us, you know, throughout the world, you begin to observe that perhaps the male begins to look like the female and the female mm-hmm. begins to look like the male, you know? It's yeah. like all of us that have dogs, the dog has a certain characteristics that our character has. But my thought is that through intimacy, for example, you are going to transfer cells from one body, from one organism to the other, and those cells are going to replicate, which is the basis for stem cells. You take a few, originating cells, and they develop into an organ, and that's what can happen between human beings, such that the wife can give her cells to the male, and I think that's how it's going to develop. Same thing with transplants. When we used to put in the organs into patients, and eventually they would develop certain traits that were different. And I had women ask me if their husband was going to develop the perhaps an ugly, mad character that the originating patient had. It's hard to say that, but I think there are some changes that can go through that. Now, technically, what we do is we wash out this organ so that we wash out a lot of the cells that would be debris and go into the organism so that there is no host or organ against the host. So, yeah, that can happen. I believe in that.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Well, there are clearly so many things that we don't know. But in you've had a long career as a heart surgeon, 35 years. I imagine things have changed incredibly over those 35 years.
Yes. Number one, the most common surgery that was performed in the United States up until recently was coronary artery bypass. And when I began, we were making cuts from the neck to the abdomen and from the groin to the ankle. And there were huge, huge cuts. And now we have technology by which, thank God we have it, through a small little hole, you can do the bypass, you can take out the leg vein, I'm sorry, and so there's a lot of new advances that are putting us in the right place. We do robotic surgery through small little holes, and pretty soon we're going to, once we work out this litigious aspect that we have in America, a surgeon in Los Angeles or New York can be doing, the telemetry surgery in another city or country. And that's going to come hopefully in a short while from now. We just have to work out some bugs from it.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's just mind-boggling and we know that it's going to happen, and it's going to happen soon.
Yeah, it's progressive. we're going to get there.
All right. Now, we know that there are over 600,000 deaths from heart disease every year. I think it's 650,000. It's probably increasing. And there are many, many people that suffer from a type 2 adult onset diabetes. And my passion is food. And we're learning more and more about the power of food and how it can prevent and often reverse heart disease and diabetes. You never mention food in your book.
No, but it's a very important aspect of it. I learned a lot through my daughter as she was fighting anorexia nervosa. Number one. Number two, as a heart surgeon, I do recommend certain diets. One of them is the Mediterranean diet, which is very good in the societies of cardiology in America. I just voted it as the most preventive and health-wise diet for cardiovascular disease, which is a mixture of fish and some white meat with nuts, vegetables, and a little bit of red wine. So the American Heart Association recommends about 4 ounces of wine a day. You can go up to 8 ounces, but you got to be careful about it. But yeah, there are certain diets that we do recommend for cardiovascular health. And in the long run, it has created some improvement in longevity in patients that are studied. So yeah, there's a lot to be said about that for diets and the way that we, you have to recommend exercise, of course, which is a very important aspect of heart health. But we can do better in America and throughout the world in as far as improving or decreasing the number of deaths from heart disease just by diet.
Well, yeah, I think we definitely can do a lot of improvement. And the thing is that our technology is so incredible and so advanced, and we can do so much. And what frustrates me is that we can be doing much more for diseases that we know are not preventable and take that technology and use it for those things like paralysis and other things where people have accidents or some really bizarre diseases. But heart disease, I personally don't think the Mediterranean diet is the best diet. And I don't, I'm a vegan, and I come from the plant strong world. And I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, who wrote Preventing Heart Disease. And there's a documentary called Forks Over Knives. But there's this big movement now to focus on the power of plant foods and how it can really reverse heart disease. I really think that that's some of where we're really going to improve in the future. I mean, I hope so, because those things are easy.
I think we will. I think that it's up to us as physicians and, people like you helping, and trying to put the word out that it can be done. I was president of the American Heart Association, and I stood up one day in the conference room and I said, people, we're dealing with a lot of the population that they, when they go to the store, they're going to get milk and bread for their kids. And that's it. That's what they care about, feeding their kids. I mean, those of us who are a little bit better off socioeconomically, yes, we do take a look at the labels and the calories and the nitrates and all of that. But I think that there's a lot of room, like you said, so we can push it. And there are vegetarian diets that I think will help us. And you're in a better position to tell me that, if you have any particular suggestions.
Yes, well, there's two great books out. One is called The End of Diabetes by Dr. Joel Fuhrman, and he talks from a really detailed perspective. I had him on the show a few weeks ago about medication and how some of it actually increases cardiovascular disease and the things that you can do to really, if you have type 1 diabetes, to reduce your insulin requirement, and if you have type 2, how you can totally turn it around. It's really fascinating, powerful stuff. I had a few other questions I want to talk about. This, you mentioned privilege, how some of us have more privilege and we can choose better foods. But also in the medical environment, there's a great deal of privilege. And I remember you mentioned when you were an intern, I think, or a new physician, and you had to take someone off life support and you wanted to resuscitate him, but his choice was do not resuscitate.
Correct, yes.
And I wonder about those who don't have access to great health care. They end up just dying. And then those who have access to good health care have a choice. They could not be resuscitated, or they could have all kind be put on all kinds of machines to keep them going.
Yes, absolutely. The advanced directive, you can write one as you go into the hospital, whether you want a tube or medication, and I think that we've gotten to the point where we can be selective. The only problem is the degree of information that patient has. It's our duty to make sure that they understand fully, what they're getting into. And, we as children of parents, I don't think that we have that hard of a choice when we see if they're suffering, if their life has become so limited. We can say, okay, that's enough, stop it, let them be at peace. For our children, I think it's a lot different. I think that we're learning a lot from the cancer patients, mm-hmm. how their survival now is getting better, thank God. I think it's great, and I think that, the choices that we're having to make for our younger patients, the children, are getting better. So we're learning, we're getting better, and I think that we're going in the right direction.
Another thing you mentioned was that early on in your career, you put in very long hour days, and now there are more restrictions about doctors spending so much time in the hospital because it's not good for anybody. Everybody gets tired.
you do.
But there's all kinds of things in hospitals. We're seeing so much these viruses and the hygiene problems. Do you see some hope there and some? Because some say that the second greatest cause of death is hospital care.
Yes, absolutely. Don't go into the hospital. They're dirty. They really are. It's an accumulation of pus and, all the terrible things that are around, especially some of the viruses. I'm a Republican by vote. We won't talk about politics, but but as a physician, I do have to understand the Obamacare that's coming, how we're going to best deliver it to the patients, how we're going to take care of them from now on. And one of the directions that we're going is to decrease the size of hospitals and to have as much as we can care as an outpatient. And so we are going to have to reinvent the machines, the care for some of these patients, such that we can deliver it at home. And we're going to have a series of healthcare delivery agents, to go out to their homes and take care of them. So things are going to change, and it's coming. There's no question about it. I think that it's going to be redistributed such that, all this infections that you hear about, they went in for open heart surgery and they got staff at the hospital. That's a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine being more sorrowful than to think that I made the cut. It's my patient, and my patient came in better situation that I left him in. It's a huge promise, and sometimes the promise is broken, and it's a terrible thing to happen.
The last thing I wanted to talk about is love, because I believe above all else, love heals. And it's so important to have love, be surrounded by supportive friends and family. And it's really magical at some point. I remember reading in your book when you talked about this wife who brought a rabbi in to speak to our husband, Larry, who was not stable. And then all of a sudden he was stable. It's kind of, you really have to realize there's so much more that's bigger and greater than all of us out there when you see something like that happen.
Absolutely.
My prescription for you, Dr. Nuño, is lots of dark leafy green vegetables, onions, mushrooms, raw nuts and seeds, and legumes. Lighten up on the meat and dairy, and limited processed foods, and you'll do fine.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
I will take your advice. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Go forward then.
All the best with your book.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, there you go. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. Now, you know, you can call into this show if you have any comments or questions, and the number is 1-888-874-4888. I don't say that very often because I usually get wrapped up talking to my guests, but I'm always happy to hear from you. And you certainly can send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And if any of you are in the South Florida area, I am going to be speaking this Friday night. I'm looking right now for the information. May 3rd, it's a vegan potluck for Earth Save Miami at the Tamarack Community Center. You can find out all the specifics if you visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and click on the Talks tab. That's going to be a lot of fun. And lots of information out there about heart disease. We talked a while ago about this new study that came out linking carnitine and how it changes into what are the initials? Something like TMAO or T, you know what I'm talking about. But it develops arteriosclerosis, and there's all kinds of back and forth conversation about this now because there are people that don't want to know that their meat and eggs might be causing arteriosclerosis and now having more scientific proof on that subject. But, you know, when it all comes down to health, for me, it's dark leafy green vegetables. And when you have a chance, you can visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. I just put back on the homepage my It's All About Green show because people have been asking me about it and aren't sure where to find it. So I just put it right back front and center on the front page. It's all about juicing, blending, what's the difference, steamed greens, salads. Just get more greens in your diet. And remember, there's nothing kale can't do. Okay, let's take a break. And we're going to be back and talking with Harold Brown of Farmkind. So a few more minutes and we'll be right back. I'm back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It is April 30th, 2013. And I really want to say again, if you have any comments and questions to give me a call, now would be a great time because my next guest is not available at the moment, and I'm not sure if he will be joining us this half hour, but we will see if he does manage to connect with us. But in the meanwhile, I am here, and I'm going to be talking about my favorite subject, food, which I can do 24 hours a day. The number is 1-888-874-4888. I was not surprised at all with my last guest, to hear what he had to say about food. Now, this was clearly a very skilled cardiologist, and he saved many, many lives. And he wrote a very, very lovely, touching book with wonderful stories. And he experienced joy and heartache and had people literally die in his arms from time to time, some of them people that were very dear to him. But the thing that he clearly does not know enough about is food. And the question is, how do we have this disconnect with people who truly care about health and truly care about saving lives and yet don't know about something that is so essential? Now, part of it, of course, has to do with all the information that doctors need to learn when they're in school. And as technology becomes more complicated and more specialized, there's far more information that they need to learn. So I don't necessarily want to put the blame on them, but we do have an obligation. We have an obligation as patients, whenever we see our doctors, to let them know what our expectations are. For example, I don't go to the doctor very often, but when I was getting a full checkup, my primary care physician wanted me to go to a cardiologist and have a stress test and a variety of other things. And I had this conversation with this cardiologist. He was young, and I kept saying to him, "Why aren't you talking more to me about food?" And he pointed a checklist to me of the items that he talks about with all of his patients. And diet was either item one or two on the top, along with smoking. And he said he does mention it. But I felt that he didn't mention it enough. You know, you can say in a blank, "Well, you know, you really need to change your diet if you want to get well." It's more than that. It needs to be enforced that it is essential for health, quality of life, longevity. The patient needs to be responsible as well as the doctor. We can't just leave our life in someone else's hands. And I'm a big proponent of medical treatment for many, many things. Our technology is incredible, and there are so many things that we can take care of today with medical treatment. But we are such an essential part of it. And this one doctor that I was just talking to, he discusses in his book — we didn't go over it in detail when I interviewed him — but he did have heart disease. He did have a heart attack. He did have diabetes, and he needs to change his diet. It's that simple if he really wants to have excellent health. And many people today are promoting this Mediterranean diet. Now, the Mediterranean diet is better than the standard American diet of highly processed foods, but it's not the ideal. And I think we're at a point, 2013, the 21st century, where we don't know what the ideal diet is. I like to say that, but we're getting close to what can really give us quality of life for a very long time. And that needs to get more press. Okay, so we're doing it here at the Progressive Radio Network. I know there are other people on the Progressive Radio Network who don't agree with what I believe is the ideal diet. So there is a bit of confusion. I get that. But I think we agree on many, many things. Most of us who are passionate about nutrition agree about the power of plant foods. Dark leafy green vegetables are great for boosting the immune system, and raw nuts and seeds. There's a lot of studies now that talk about how they are very helpful with heart disease and creating a healthy body. As I mentioned before, I'm in Florida right now, and after premiering our Swingin' Gourmets show in California last week, I was really looking forward to relaxing here for a while in between giving talks. And on last Wednesday, I was in California, and I had a floater shower. Have you ever heard of that? Some people Some people who are very nearsighted see these floaters. They're like little amoebas that flash across the eyes. And on occasion, you might see a whole — I think of it as like a reversed Milky Way of black dots. Well, I had one of these swim across my eye. It just lasted a few minutes. It was really a concern to me, but I didn't think about it until I was here in Florida on Friday, and I actually went to the Eye Institute in Miami, an excellent, excellent place, because I was concerned that I might have a retinal tear or retinal detachment, which, if you don't take care of it, can lead to blindness. And this is where Going for medical treatment for something like this, where we have a lot of great technology, is so important. And then somebody recently told me that pineapple is excellent for taking care of floaters. I'm not sure if that's true or not, and if you have any other suggestions, I'm open to hearing about them. But now we are going to bring on my next guest. I'm so glad that he is with us. Harold Brown is the founder of Farmkind, and he is a character in the documentary Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home. He spent over half of his life in agriculture, growing up on a beef farm in Michigan and later working in the dairy industry. Harold has been involved in the behind-the-scenes operations of food production that uses animals. Today, Harold is an activist advocating for sustainable food production, social and environmental justice, animal rights, and peace through nonviolence. Harold Brown, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Well, thank you for having me, Karen.
Hi. You know, I know a little bit about your story. I've been to your website, and I've seen the Peaceable Kingdom. We have some stereotypes about farmers, and we see them in films from time to time. They're usually very calm, very quiet, peaceful people that have some kind of innate connection or a learned connection with the rhythms of life and the planet and plants and food. And I bring this up because then there's this kind of disconnect. How do some farmers end up raising animals and slaughtering them when they have what appears to be this deep understanding of the flow of life?
Well, it's just part of the indoctrination you go through as a child. In my case, the indoctrination started, of course, with my parents, and this is what we do for food and for making a living, and then everything just kind of cascades upon that. The indoctrination was reinforced by my extended family because I grew up basically on my grandparents' farm, and then the surrounding farms were my great uncles, and then the larger agricultural community that was around us, and then 4-H, church, FFA, and I went to a land grant college, which their land grants, if people don't know, are set up to teach farmers how to farm. And but I think the largest reinforcer I had to my indoctrination was television. Every time a commercial came on, every commercial break seemed to sell some food product, and all those food products had animals in them. So those of us who did that work, we figured, well, we're meeting a demand, we're feeding a hungry world, we're doing good work.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty deeply instilled, in our culture.
But still, as a young person, you felt there was something not quite right?
Yeah, and every farm kid that raises farm animals feels that, too. It's, you get attached to the animals, and, the first thing that you're taught is don't name them, because your parents and grandparents and so on understand that if you make too deep of a connection, you're not going to be able to kill them and eat them. So
right.
You don't name them. Then it actually happened to me when I was, oh golly, I must have been 8 years old or so. My grandfather had bought at auction had bought a dairy cow. We raised beef cows. We had Angus. But he got this Holstein steer, and he thought, well, he's really big, and let's see how big he gets and so on. But being that he was a dairy cow, the Holstein, he was very gentle. And people may not know that dairy cattle have been selectively bred to be docile, so they're easy to handle and milk. Where beef cattle are not, they can be very cantankerous, and they can be dangerous at times. So my brother and I got attached to this cow. We named him Max. And then one day we came home from school and went to do chores, and Max wasn't there. And we asked our grandfather, where'd Max go? And they said, well, we slaughtered him. And we freaked out. But my grandfather, what he did is he took all the packages of meat and he took the wax pencil and he wrote Max on all the packages.
Oh.
and they went in one end of the freezer, and you know, the rest he was in the other rest of the freezer, and they just knew that, you know, when we were going to have hamburger or steak or something, they just didn't grab Max when we were going to be eating. So, you know, it, and that might sound strange to people, but, you know, this, it comes back to the question you had about farmers and their degree of compassion and the disconnect. You know, obviously my grandfather was very sensitive to, you know, our emotional state and our connection to Max. But on the other hand, you know, it wasn't a question of should I stop doing this altogether, but rather let's just mediate the situation right now and have Max labeled so that the boys don't eat him. And that's how we dealt with that. But I think, too, that one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that by and large, most farmers don't, especially even small farms, but in particularly large farms, they aren't connected with the transport and slaughter, even the auction of the animals. A lot of farmers are not part of that because they don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Or they know that it's an emotional place they don't want to go. I've known many farmers like that. They've never been to a slaughterhouse. They've never actually, I know some farmers have never actually killed and butchered an animal themselves on their own farm. They just let that to somebody else. Again, there's degrees to the disconnect, even among farmers. So it's, you know, it's different for everybody, and everybody's on this journey at a different point. And, farmers do have a connection, I wouldn't say it's deeper. I would just say that it's different. And they don't want to make that connection, but sometimes it does happen. I've had this happen in my life. I'll share a real quick story. When they were showing Peaceful Kingdom, The Journey Home in Cleveland, it was 2 years ago now, it was a huge screening. There were 600 people at this screening. And it was during this legislative initiative in Ohio called Ohioans for Humane Farms. Well, evidently, Farm Bureau had contacted some dairy farmers in the state and told them, you know, go see this animal rights film and, you know, challenge them. Okay, well, after the film was over, there were, you know, tons of people talking to us, and the director of the film and videographer, Jenny Stein, she brought this older gentleman over to me, and she says, well, this is a farmer, and he's asking me questions I can't answer. And I said, okay. And I got talking to him. I said, so what'd you think of the film? And he looked and he says, well, I don't agree with, you know, a lot of the stuff that's in that film, but, and then he stopped short. And I said, well, did something in the film kind of, you know, speak to you? And he just kind of was looking off in the distance and thought. And then he just looked me square in the eye. He said, what the hell did we do to ourselves?
Oh.
And, you know, this is a guy who's got a huge dairy farm in central Ohio. And I was like, what got him was that the footage of the 4-H auction. And every kid who's ever raised livestock and taken animals to the fair, you know, via 4-H, that first year is the worst. Second year can be almost as bad, but you get desensitized along the way. But that first year is terrible because you spend a year raising a cow, a sheep, a pig, and they become literally
your best friend.
Animal. Yeah, they're a companion animal. I mean, they run to see you when you come home from school, and they follow you around. You know, they're just there by your side all the time, and you're grooming them, and you're feeding them, and you're taking care of them, and you know, taking extra special care of them, and they appreciate that. I mean, they bond to you. And then at the end of the fair, you have to auction them off. And they're going either to a slaughterhouse or they're going to a breeder. And it's the only two places they'll go. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. But the thing is we, you know, the older we get, and particularly we tend to kind of disconnect from that and forget about it. We push it down, you know, we can't even keep it bottled up inside. And then, you know, for this guy, that film, you know, opened that bottle for him, you know, it just, the genie was out again. And, you know, that's really what it's about, is getting these people to connect to their, you know, to get honest with themselves emotionally.
Well, that, the 4-H concept to me has always been so twisted and one of the uglier sides of humanity. And what does it teach us? We develop a bond with an animal and the animal has trust in us, and then we break that trust. And it probably leads to, it could lead to a long life of relationships without trust. With humans, because we treat our animals horribly, we also treat each other horribly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's part of the well, what I call the domestication paradigm, is that when we domesticated animals and farm animals in particular, but also cats and dogs, we created this artificial relationship that put, where human interests always trump animal interests.
I didn't know that. I know that animals have been bred over thousands of years, but I didn't realize that cows' characteristic of being docile was something that was bred into them. And well, I learned something new every day. It makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to be able to handle them. You got to be able to milk them and so on. And it's, I mean, they can, well, and they're also taking that even further, it's like one of the things I talk about occasionally is that people who are championing welfare reforms, you know, I tell them, I say, you know, be careful what you wish for, because if the only metric you have for, or the main metric you have in your activism is the suffering of animals, well, they're engineering animals now through selective breeding. But in particular with dairy cows, they used at the front end of it a bit of cloning technology to develop a Holstein cows, which are now showing up in the United States, which, as the researchers in England who developed these cows, they call them vegetable animals. Long story short, what they did is they used cloning technology, which they've become fairly successful at, but clones over second, third generation develop a lot of problems, and they're not viable, and it's really expensive. So what they do is they, within a generation, they, through cloning, they'll hyper express a particular characteristic and immediately take that genetic material and put it into a you know, a regular cow. And then, considering that cows give birth every 9 months, I mean, well, I have a 9-month pregnancy, within 2 to 3 years, they were able to hyper-express that characteristic in a stable, conventional animal. And as the researchers put it, it was basically, they called them zombie cows because their frontal cortexes are non-operational. Mm-hmm. In other words, these are cows that are born basically like they've had a lobotomy done. And they're super easy to handle. I mean, and it's a win for everybody that's involved, because for the farmers, they're easier to handle. Well, people have probably heard stories about when you milk cows, playing soothing music or classical music. My grandfather used to do that. He used to play classical music. The cows tend to relax more, and they give more milk, a little bit more milk, but the butterfat content goes up. The less stressed a cow is, the higher the butterfat content. And so you've got this where that plus, you know, everything that's connected to the handling, raising, and using and milking of these cows is now you've taken stress out of it. So the farmers are getting a cow easier to handle. They're getting more milk. the dairy plants are getting milk that's got higher butterfat content, which means, you know, better quality, quote unquote, dairy products, and more of certain things like butter and so on, and premium ice creams. And then at the other end of the spectrum would be the welfare reform people, because now if your metric is suffering, then now you have an animal that can't suffer. So now you have a whole new ethical dilemma. What do you do with, I mean, how can you violate the interest of an animal that cannot suffer, that cannot, you know, experience the world?
I don't know. It gives me chills. It makes me think of the movie Cloud Atlas, where they were breeding these young women to live for a year to work as a sales slave of sorts. Anyway, it's just very sci-fi and very creepy.
Agriculture, especially at this day and age, I've had one dairy professor in Vermont who basically, you know, was very Ayn Randian about it. It was that, you know, I said, well, then, you know, he said, well, we can't treat these animals poorly. I said, why do you say that? He says, because we are the God.
Oh, gosh. Even though these animals are docile, they must feel pain.
Oh, they do. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We just have a few more minutes left, and I wanted to just touch on, I was talking to a cardiologist in the first half of this show, and I know that you experienced some heart disease early in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And was that food related?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah. It was, my particular problem was high triglycerides, which I got from my father. He died from heart disease, as did my mother. But the thing for me was that with high triglycerides, it's when you put saturated fats and sugar together. And like ice cream is the bomb when it comes to triglycerides. And at the time, I was working in a dairy plant, and we were making this stuff. And I was eating, I mean, I'm not, my wife will swear to this. I would eat on average 3 gallons of ice cream a week or more.
Wow.
And, I was just putting myself down a hole. And, when I got injured at work, the doctor, our union doctor, he said, well, this is how you deal with it. And I said, how come the doctors who work on my dad over at University of Michigan, they can't figure this out? They said, well, that's because I'm an osteopath and I have more nutrition training than an MD. I go, wow. And that was my first step.
Well, Harold, thank you for joining me today and sharing your stories. They're really quite moving. And I'm so glad that you're on our side now and sharing your stories, because we need to be talking so much about this and making the world a better place. And you certainly are doing your part. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the work you're doing, too.
Okay. And thank you for joining me again. Your website is farmkind.org, and people can find you there.
Yes.
And watch Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, another great documentary that you are a featured character in. Right?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks again for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. We've come to the end of this program today. And visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me emails at info@realmeals.org. And one more thing, have a very delicious week.